Hello and welcome to Bowel Cancer UK's podcast. Now, we're the UK's leading bowel cancer charity. We're determined to save lives and improve the quality of life of everyone affected by bowel cancer. We fund targeted research, provide expert information and support to patients and their families. We educate the public and professionals about the disease and campaign for early diagnosis and access to best treatment and care. Hello, I'm George Alagaya. You probably know me as a BBC journalist, but I've got a life outside the BBC. I'm a granddad, I've got a wonderful wife, I've written a book, having a good time. But also, my guest today, Barbara Hibbert, I am living with stage 4 cancer. And as I say, today we're going to talk about surgery and bowel cancer with, as I said, Barbara Hibbert, who was diagnosed with stage 4 bowel cancer back in September 2014. Just a little bit after me, Barbara. Yes. We also have Nicola Fernhead, who is a surgeon at Addenbrooke's Hospital in Cambridge, a pretty famous hospital. I'm sure you've all heard of it. Welcome, both of you, to this podcast. Barbara, let's start with you. Just tell us briefly about, let's call it your cancer journey.
Okay, well, I was first diagnosed, as you said, in September 2014. I'd been to give blood, which I'd done 50-odd times before, and they wouldn't take it because I was anaemic, sent me to the GP. Unfortunately, I had a switched-on GP who put me on a two-week emergency referral, but I was far too busy and important to... visit him or get the blood tests. But in the end, within a month of seeing him, I was being operated on for stage 4 bowel cancer, as you say. And at that point, I had, I think, an 8% chance of surviving 5 years. And here I am, on 5 years.
I'm going to interrupt you, actually. I'm quite interested you said you had an 8% chance, because I know a similar situation. I mean, 6 months before you, I decided I didn't want to know about chances and survival rates, but what you kind of Googled it and found all these things.
Oh yes, I'm an obsessive Googler. I want to know everything, and it doesn't really. Well, I mean, I wasn't very happy about the idea of only having an 8% chance of 5 years. And at that point, I'd got a granddaughter on the way who I thought I might not see. And actually, she's just started nursery school and I dropped her off this morning before I came here. So things are not bad.
Nicola, I just wonder, I mean, when you see patients, do you talk about percentage survival rates and that kind of thing? Do you think it's a good thing or not?
I think patients want to know, but first of all, the hearing the news is the hardest thing, and that takes a little while for the penny to drop what you're actually facing, what the implications of that are. You're often being talked to about treatments and what might be offered, and those treatments are often quite complex, and I'm sure we'll talk more about that later. But actually, there are those who simply want to start something as quickly as possible. Yeah. And feel as though they're starting the fight. And there are others who really do want to know, and they want to know in fine detail. As clinicians, though, it's quite hard for us to predict exactly what it is. I don't think I've ever used the phrase 8% to anybody.
Well, it seems, the thing is...
it's very precise.
Exactly. And as I think both Barbara and I know, I mean, this thing is a very unpredictable disease. And, you're kind of good 1 week and not the next. You have good chances 1 year and not the next, that kind
and
of thing.
It depends on treatments and response to treatments. And your chances of things change as you go along the journey in terms of what those odds are, change at all times. So to give somebody a very concrete figure right at the outset, I think you have to be realistic. Without a doubt, sure. One has to be realistic, but also providing hope.
Because I remember my...
Very important.
Sorry to interrupt. I remember my surgeon saying the thing about these kind of average survival rates is they include someone perhaps who's really, really ill, possibly quite old, has had a difficult life anyway, perhaps, diet and that kind of thing, and they include kind of young, fit people. So it's really hard to find.
Nobody told me 8%. That was from Googling. And also, the statistics are always 5 years out of date because, treatments change over time. But for 5-year survival, it has to be people who were diagnosed 5 years before that point.
So a month after, I think you said just now, a month after, there you were about to get surgery. Just describe the surgery. What was it? What did you know about it when you were told?
At that point, they told me I was on a curative pathway and that I would have a bowel resection and then a liver resection with chemo either before or after. There was a lot of debate about whether I should have the chemo, which obviously I didn't understand. I understand a lot more now. I used to think medicine was a very precise science, and I realise it's much more of an art, and you can't predict things, as Nicola's just said. So I had my bowel resection at the local...
And resection, we should just say, and probably most people listening to this know what resection means, but basically, Nicola, what is a resection?
Resection means removal of the piece of bowel where the cancer is.
Right.
If it's in another part of the body, then it's removal of that part of the body.
On bowel, my colorectal surgeon calls it plumbing. He goes, snip, he said, basically I snip, and I joined the two bits together. Anyway, sorry, I interrupted you, Barbara.
So I think I said it was a curative pathway, but I didn't believe them. At that point, I thought I was going to die. Later on, I had a recurrence, and I was told that I was incurable and inoperable, and I didn't believe that either. I think I'm just a contrary sort of person.
We'll call you positive, I think.
So I had a right hemicolectomy. It meant that the cancer was in the cecum, just above the appendix.
God, I'm impressed. You know all these technical terms. I've run miles from technical terms, actually. I sort of leave it to people like Nicola. I think it's your job to know all this. Just get me better.
And then they... I never had a stoma because it was not in a place where I was going to need a stoma, which my surgeon was very happy to tell me. And at that point I said, but it's a small price to pay to live. And now I realise it's not, you know, it's the plumbing job, whether you have a stoma or not. It's not... about anything else.
No, and it's not the end of the world. I had a stoma, ileostomy bag and so on. It's not the end of the world. Yeah.
So my first surgery was just with the local general surgeon who did the colorectal stuff as well, and he was actually brilliant. And I realised far more innovative than some of the other people that I saw later.
Well, let's come to the innovation. But Nicola, I'm interested because in my case, they went for the liver first. And then the bowel. So how do you, as a surgeon, or I suppose discussions with the oncologist, how do you decide which to go for first?
So every patient needs to be considered in their own rights, depending on the cancer, how fit they are, what the different likelihood is of each different area. And there isn't a one-size-fits-all. Because there are complexities around the decision making, which influence what you should do first. Sometimes because if you don't do something and it gets worse, it may not be possible to do it. So sometimes that drives it. Sometimes it's about access to care. And we do know that there's great variation across the country in terms of patients being offered, for example, having the removal of the bowel first, having liver done first, or even sometimes having both together.
Wow.
Which is, you know, more and more where it's possible, really should be offered if it is possible. But the decisions are not made in isolation. They're made in a multidisciplinary team meeting, which involves representation from pathologists, radiologists, surgeons, oncologists, specialist nurses, palliative care medicine very often. And the nurses are there very much to present the patient's point of view. So in other words, they're to bring the patient to the heart of the decision making in terms of what the patient wants, what's important to them, and to help the team give the best advice. But it is advice. It's not a decision.
Okay.
The decisions then have to be made with the patient and the representative clinicians who are then giving those arguments which have been discussed in the MDT, multidisciplinary team meeting, with the patient and then coming to a decision with the patient.
I mean, you say with the patient, but I mean, you know, Barbara's obviously, you know, one of these people who Googles away and really on top of things. I've got to say, I was absolutely the opposite. I kind of wanted you, Nicola, you know, you spent whatever it is, 20, 30 years at this. Just tell me what needs to be done.
And that's exactly it. Patients are different. And what they want from their clinicians is also different in terms of the amount of information, the amount of information about risks, the amount of information about impact. And you're really there to tailor that information to the patient and deal with them. Sometimes there is a best option. Okay. There's no doubt about that. There is a best option, and you have to put that across. But if there are nuances in the treatment, whether it should be, well, perhaps the liver is a little bit dicey, it's a bit close to some of the central plumbing in the liver, which might make it difficult to do if the cancer gets a bit worse, maybe we should do that now, then that would be an influence that you should be discussing with the patient as to why they might have liver surgery first.
I mean, I think you said it's not one size fits all. So I often, because of my public profile, I get emails, people know that I had liver surgery first. And they kind of wonder if, you know, the reason I'm around 5.5 years is because of that. And they, you know, but you're saying it doesn't mean, you know, going first with the liver or going first with the bowel doesn't make the difference in survival terms. It's what's right for that patient at that time.
At the moment, we don't have that information. What I'm trying to say, in terms of concrete, high-quality evidence, we don't yet have that information. We're working on it to get it.
But you know, you've got two patients, two people living with cancer. One had bowel first, and one had liver first, and we're both around. So
spot on. that is part of it, because it is. There are sometimes there's a no-brainer as to which should be done first, and there are other times where it is open to it. And this is why the research hasn't been done, because it's very difficult to find equal groups.
Can I just very quickly, very, very briefly ask you, I should have done this earlier, what sort of surgery do you specialise in?
good point. I'm a colorectal cancer surgeon.
Colorectal, so you're a plumber.
Yes, my in other words, but I also work within our advanced cancer team with a lot of patients with metastatic disease.
Okay, great. I should have done that earlier on in my introduction. Right. So Barbara, I stopped you when you were saying, so this general surgeon, as you called him, was it a him?
It was a him.
It was a him, as you called it. You said he was innovative. So what was that about?
I had keyhole surgery. He used glue to fasten me up, which I just assumed was the way things were done now. But then when I had my liver surgery, it was done by staples. When I had my third surgery, which was cytoreductive surgery in HIPEC, it was both glue and staples.
Right.
And I actually met a Polish colorectal surgeon who I was discussing this with, and he said, oh, well, in Poland, he said, we still use stitches. So I said, why? And he said, cost. So I realised that that's a...
You said a couple of things there which I want to come back to. Cytoreductive surgery, everybody listening, just you know, wait out, we'll sort of explain that in a minute. And what was the other thing you said? HIPEC. So that we've got to come back to that. Nicola, I've been told that chemo manages cancer but surgery gets rid of it. As a principle, is that fair?
I think it's a good principle. We have to remember that for the better part of a century, surgery has been the mainstay in terms of managing patients with bowel cancer. And for those who do not have spread elsewhere in the body, so in other words, do not have stage 4 disease, actually it is their best chance of cure very often, with the chemotherapy adding, in a small number of patients, an additional survival benefit, meaning that they might live longer, be less likely to get the cancer back. In stage 4 disease, the cancer has already spread to the rest of the body. And if, in simplistic terms, chemotherapy is given into the bloodstream. And because the bloodstream goes all over your body, it's much more likely to be effective in other places. Chemotherapy is also good at mopping up and targeting individual cells. It's less good at dealing with lumps of tumour.
Right.
And so that's where, again, in simplistic terms, if you think about it, surgery comes to the fore, because even in potentially incurable disease, there might be an advantage to removing lumps of tumour, whether it's in the bowel, the liver, the lungs, in the peritoneal cavity, that's inside the lining of the abdomen. There is
someone
a
called it
there.
Like a, it's like a cling film. This peritoneal lining.
It's where you get little seedlings of tumour on the lining of the inside of the abdominal cavity. All of those are forms of spread. And if they are relatively isolated and can be safely removed without too much impact on the patient, then surgery still has a role to offer.
Okay. So, Barbara, let's go back to you. So we've got to the point where you've had bowel surgery.
Yes.
You then had liver surgery.
I had chemotherapy as well between the bowel and the liver surgery, which was another debate amongst the doctors. In fact, the surgeon, I think, argued for both sides with me, you know, whether he should do chemo first or surgery first. And in the same consultation, he argued for both sides. Okay. So how could I make a decision?
So let's stick to the surgery. I mean, I wish people could see you here. I mean, you're just so bubbly, so full of energy. I can't believe, you know, it's difficult to believe you've ever had cancer. So when you were told you were going to have surgery, I mean, this big stuff, you know, you knew you were going to have bowel surgery, liver surgery. What went through your mind?
I don't know. I think I've always been someone who just takes what happens as it happens. So I just thought it was something you had to get on with. I think my family found it much more difficult than I did.
You've got, you're married? You got.
I'm
kids.
Married, two children and now a granddaughter.
Okay. Right. You think your family found it more difficult than you did?
Yes, well, I think ultimately I knew that if the worst happened and I died, well, that was that. As far as I'm kind of no worries about what happens afterwards, there's nothing.
I hope
afterwards.
You don't mind me saying, I'm not challenging you, but you make it sound quite glib. I'm sure it wasn't.
No, it took time to get to this point, but I think for your family, they've got an after to deal yes. with, which you won't have to deal with. No, it takes some time to come to that conclusion and to make peace with yourself.
Yeah, that's exactly right, isn't it? It took me about 3 to 6 months after my diagnosis. I called it getting to a place of contentment.
Yes, I'd agree with that. Yeah,
I needed that because just to kind of look at my life and say, you know, whatever happens, actually, do you know what? I'm content. It's been pretty. I literally had a list of good things that happened to me and bad things. Mm. I realized that the good things were the list of good things was much, much longer than the list of bad things. Okay, so
may I add something?
Of course, of course.
I think this is one of the areas where we as clinicians have to be very careful about the advice we give to patients, particularly as we tend to concentrate just on the treatments, on what you need to do next as a patient in order to get to the assumption being survival and good survival. But actually, there is so much to be said for the quality of that survival. And so I would always encourage patients to think about themselves and their families, just as Barbara has said, to think about those holidays they want to do, that list of things that they still might have in mind that they want to. Because actually, as you both know, there is often a length of survival.
Yeah.
And with that, there should be quality. So as clinicians, I think we need to help people focus more on that in terms of making sure that they do think about themselves and their families and what they want to do.
Yeah, there are people who pursue treatment and cash in, you know, sell the houses and things like that to have treatments abroad, which are really of no benefit, and they've missed time doing other things.
That's an interesting point, actually. I'll tell you, I'll be honest, it's kind of crossed my mind sometimes, you know, is there somebody out there, you know, in some other countries who could do something for me that people here, doctors here can't? I mean, where are we on bowel cancer? I mean,
we're certainly not absolutely top of the list in terms of survival across Europe, that is, but we're pretty high up. And the other thing is that the UK in particular is very good at bowel cancer research. So yes, there are some cutting edge innovations, treatments available, and certainly we offer a lot of early trials to patients who are looking for that, a possibility of one more thing that might help. I think there are plenty of opportunities for patients who want to explore those options. But our mainstays of treatment, they're pretty much there. Mm. You know, that you're not missing anything in terms of broad chemotherapy that is not
and
available.
There are a lot of snake oil salesmen out there, which you need
for
to be aware
sure.
of. And I put that on a forum once, something about beware of snake oil salesmen. And one of the responses was, snake oil, where can I buy it?
Okay, so now, you know, everybody knows liver surgery, bowel surgery, you get the picture. But you've had this other thing, cytoreductive surgery, which you mentioned earlier, and I said we were going to come back. So what is that? And let's get your layperson's view of what it is, and perhaps...
That is very, very major surgery. For that, my husband dropped me off at the hospital at 7:30 in the morning, and he didn't get a phone call to say it was all over till 11:30 that night.
Oh my God! So that's what, 16 hours or something, is it?
I guess. I mean, I obviously didn't go into surgery straight away.
But that's a long time for a family to be sitting around waiting.
Yeah. Now I knew nothing about that, so it wasn't a problem to me. But I think for him, that must have been an awful long day.
Okay.
And he was told not to worry, that, you know, if it got very late, that was a good sign, not a bad
right.
sign.
Right. So, Nicola, what exactly is cytoreductive surgery?
Okay. So this is for the disease of in the peritoneal cavity. So these little seedlings we mentioned earlier. It's usually only done when the cancer is clear everywhere else. So by that, I mean that usually not always, but usually the bowel resection has been done, often the liver disease has been done, or there's very limited disease in either of those two places, which can also be removed at the same time. The idea is that you take away the lining of the bowel in its entirety. So you're stripping off all of the lining where any of these seedlings might be.
Can I just interrupt, Nicola? So I know I described it as cling film before. This is a kind of, what is it, to keep the abdominal contents together?
So there, yes, it does.
So if you take it off, does everything just spill all over the place?
No, it doesn't. It's not that it spills. It's actually the bowel has an embryological lining to it that comes from the back of the abdomen, goes around the bowel and its blood supply and around all the bowel. But it also then goes on the inner lining of the peritoneal cavity. So this is why laparoscopic surgery is possible, because there is a space inside which has got lining on all sides, on the outer side and on the inside, which makes it possible. So it's that lining that's been removed. But with it to go a lot of other things. There is also a large fat pad in the abdominal cavity. We call it the omentum. There's also a capsule to the liver, which might be affected. And all of those areas are stripped away as well. The reason it takes so long is it's painstaking work. It's done in teams of people periodically during the day, changing over and knowing what they need to do. And also dealing with...
You wouldn't have known any of this, Barbara.
I wouldn't have known any of it.
But blissful ignorance.
I think I'd assume they must change over because I couldn't imagine being there all that time without even a cup of coffee.
Yeah.
Don't worry, there are plenty of cups of coffee. But the point of it, two other points with it is, firstly, that this is not suitable for everyone.
Okay.
In terms of people who have disease in that area, it has to be quite low volume to be successful. And we know that there isn't a huge survival advantage if there's a large volume of disease. The second point is that in some instances, and Barbara's already told us that this happened to her, that once that process of surgery is finished, that then one wants to target individual cancer cells which might still be present but not visible. And that's where the HIPEC, which is heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy,
I was going to come on to that, which you had that. So
I had that as well.
And that's done at the same time.
I thought there might be a gap.
No, it's not. Okay. It's the final part of the operation.
Okay, just say that again, Nicola. What does HIPEC stand for?
It's heated intraperitoneal chemotherapy.
Heated. So what's going on here?
So it's a form of chemotherapy. In this country, usually a drug called mitomycin, which has been heated up to make it more effective. And then the entire abdominal cavity is protected with special plastic sheets so that it doesn't burn the skin or anywhere else. And it's like a big basin is made of your abdominal cavity whilst this is allowed to contact with the entire peritoneal surface.
Oh,
and it
God.
Takes a while for that to be
heated. Done. I mean, what are we talking?
We're talking warm. We're not talking boiling. the heated is just simply because it's slightly more effective that way.
I'm just interested in something Barbara said. I mean, how long the operation took. I mean, you surgeons got to be pretty fit, haven't you? I mean,
these types of operations are not the norm for patients having bowel cancer or liver cancer surgery. These are, as I said, they're only carried out in very specialised centres nationally. And the other group of people who have very protracted operations are those who have very advanced rectal cancer or recurrent rectal cancer.
Okay.
And again, those operations take the sort of lengths of time.
But I mean, look, it was possible because presumably Barbara's, you know, pretty young. And actually, sorry, do you mind me asking, how old are you?
61.
Right, but you were, so, 55?
56 on diagnosis.
56. So pretty young and obviously, you know, very fit and not kind of positive woman.
She had a surgery this year.
I know, I was going to come after. So the patient's got to be fit, but I was also, in a sense, I mean, as a surgeon, you've got to keep yourself pretty fit if you're going to be standing over somebody for hours.
Absolutely, but this is important for any form of surgery. We know that surgical error is a real problem within surgery, and so actually it's very, very important that your team is functioning well, that you are functioning well, that you look after yourself, and actually in a long operation, we have teams coming in and breaks are had. Anesthesia these days is so safe, often it gives the anaesthetist a chance just to get things a bit better with the patient.
Right.
Even if it's just getting a little bit more oxygenation in the bottom of their lungs.
I mean, this is going to sound flippant, but what do? So you go off and have a cup of coffee, a sandwich or something?
Absolutely.
Yeah?
Absolutely. And there's always somebody there. So in other words, there's always somebody with the patient in terms of making sure that they're safe and stable. And you're more likely to function well if you are hydrated and not hypoglycemic.
Yeah.
You're much
getting
less likely
what
to
I call
make
the
mistakes.
Sugar wobblies. Mm.
Exactly.
So Barbara, let's just recap, okay? So you've had bowel surgery, you've had liver surgery. They were both 2014 and 2015.
Yes, they were close together, and at that point I was declared cured.
Okay. And then the cancer comes back. That's when you have cytoreductive surgery and the HIPEC.
No, initially I was turned down for that.
Okay.
Because they said the disease was too extensive. I was told I was inoperable and incurable and put on chemotherapy.
Hang on a minute. You're running away with
sorry.
Me. So somebody tells you you're incurable.
Yeah.
So what went on in your mind?
Well, I believe them. I'm freelance, so I contacted everybody I worked for and said, sorry, I'll finish this contract, but I won't be around for any more.
What do you do?
I taught for 30 years, and then I now do teacher training, writing resources, examining work, that sort of thing.
Right, so you wrote to everybody and said, and what about your family, your husband?
Well, again, we were all really in shock at that point, but we accepted it. I cashed my pension in. I was only travelling first class, only eating at Michelin-starred restaurants.
You're getting an idea of what this woman, Barbara, is really like.
And then after about a year, I thought, oops, I'm still here. Maybe I better just rein in some of that spending. And then after 2 and a bit years, I found that I was now suitable for the cytoreductive surgery.
So, okay, what was happening? You're told you're incurable.
So I was put on chemotherapy.
Chemotherapy, okay.
And that I was told if I didn't have a response, it would last, I might have 6 months. If I did have a response, 2 years, maybe more, but that was seen as highly unlikely. But I did have a very good response to the chemo, even though I've got a mutation, a RAS mutation, which meant I couldn't have some of the targeted treatment which is available on the NHS.
Okay, I'm going to just, again, you know, you're right across the detail. I probably should be, being a patient living with cancer, RAS mutation. Just give us a quick definition of what that means.
So increasingly with bowel cancer, the reason the prognosis tends to be so good is we know much, much more about bowel cancers, their individual profiles and how they behave. So a RAS mutation is a genetic mutation which occurs within the tumour. And it means that the tumour is not going to respond to a specific type of immunotherapy. And that's what Barbara's saying. And as I said earlier, that immunotherapy is available to patients on the NHS who have spread, so stage 4 disease.
Okay, good.
There are many others, though.
Other mutations?
Yes.
All right. We won't go into them right now. So, okay, so we've got you to the point where you've had this cytoreductive surgery. You've had HIPEC. Where are you now? Because as we just heard, you've had some surgery this year, 2019.
That was the cytoreductive. HIPEC, yeah. So that was in the middle of June, so about 4 months ago. And I think on day 5 after surgery, I was thinking, I'm not sure this was a good idea. Maybe I shouldn't have done this.
Why was that?
I was in the intensive care unit. I wasn't feeling great, and I was thinking about quality of life. And what was I, you know, how was I going to get around this and recover from it? But now I was told I would feel about 70% of what I had before after 3 months. So I was determined to beat that. And I also wanted to do some work. I got some training work that I should have been doing a month after the surgery. And I was told there was no way I could do it. So I thought, well, I'm at least going to do one day. It meant I was meeting this year's trainees. So a month after surgery, I managed to get the train by myself to Sheffield, taught them for half a day. I was probably still high on my opioids. Medicines, the stuff that all the Americans are addicted to. I don't know if I made any sense, but I did it. So I thought, that shows them.
Barbara mentioned quality of life there, Nicola. Have you ever been in the position as a surgeon where you've had to say to a patient, do you know what, I don't think your quality of life is going to be significantly improved. This is, you know, surgery is not the answer for you. I mean, have you had to give that news?
Definitely. Because as Barbara so beautifully described, actually every time a patient has surgery, there's a down bit first before there's an up bit. And if they're not going to get to the upward slope again, where they actually have regained that lost quality of life after surgery, there, and it's not going to be in the right time frame, then surgery isn't going to help their quality.
Why might not they get to that upward section?
It depends on prognosis. So in other words, if they have a burden of cancer, which is so great that they are not likely to survive very long, that's one. And then there are often other things we can do. So, you know, there are often other ways of dealing with symptoms, for example, that can be done with either minimally invasive means or non-surgical means even sometimes. There are also occasions when the patient is simply not fit enough to... Physically fit enough to, you know, there are upfront risks to having surgery. And the more frail you are, the more elderly, the more other medical problems you have, the more likely you are to have a major complication. And whilst you can have a successful bowel cancer operation to remove the cancer, there is little point if the outcome is that you have a stroke and a bed bound for the rest of your life.
Oh, gosh, yeah.
So you see that these are important, complex discussions that need to be had with a patient. And again, their own level of what they want and the risk they're prepared to take comes into that decision.
So you've got to be clear with the patient and talk to them about all the risks. I mean, we have this thing called, I mean, anyone going through this process, we sign up with these consent forms, don't we? And that's after you've had a discussion with the physician about the risks. How do you, I mean, on a human level, Nicola, how do you prepare yourself to tell someone, do you know what, I don't want to do the surgery on you?
I was going to say that that's a less hard thing to do than to tell somebody that it's not the right thing for them, because it's not actually I don't want to, but actually there are jolly good reasons why you should not be having surgery, not just about me or my decision, but actually this is not going to help you. And I have some comfort from the fact that not harming a patient is actually fundamentally important. And I also know that the quality of how you deliver that news actually will have a huge impact on the patient and their family and their own ability to then cope with it. And so I think what I do is really strive to make sure I have the time and space to have that conversation, but actually importantly, to have it.
Okay.
Because not having it leaves so many uncertain questions in a patient's mind that they're often wondering, well, maybe I'll have the surgery next time, or maybe they'll offer to me next time. And there is, and whilst it's really important that we reevaluate, just as Barbara's described, and that actually it might be the right thing next time, what you don't want to do is offer unrealistic hope.
So, Barbara, we've gone through, you know, your treatment and the various types of operations you've had. In a physical way, and we've touched on preparing your family, on the emotional strain that that is placed on both you as a patient and the family. But what about physically? What do you do or did you do before surgery to prepare yourself and after surgery to get better?
Well, I made a huge change in my lifestyle. Obviously, I couldn't do that before my first operation because it was too quick.
Yeah.
But I was overweight. I didn't take any exercise. I drank too much. I ticked all the risk factors for bowel cancer. So I've lost 4 stone.
Have you?
And I had to persuade...
And that's not just because you've had loads of surgery.
No, no, absolutely not. You've actually done... Yeah. All the nurses at the chemo unit are going, oh, treat yourself, you know, you poor you, you must have a cake or whatever. I'm going, no, I mustn't, you know, really.
Well, that's interesting,
bad.
Actually, because I remember one of my nurses or doctor, even a doctor, I think, this was during chemo, yeah. When I was on 3-4 drugs, I think, and they were worried about weight loss and appetite. And they just said to me, you know, if you want a bucket of ice cream, just take it, you know, because it's important to us that you keep your weight on.
Yeah, no, well, to me, it was important that I lost weight in a controlled way. I lost that 4 stone over a couple of years.
And did somebody suggest that to you?
No, that was through my own research. And I knew that I was overweight. I had been part of
can I just very quickly interrupt you? Is overweight, someone being overweight, a problem surgically? I mean, does it make your life difficult?
More difficult? It might make it technically more difficult, but actually what really matters is the outcomes for the patients.
Okay.
So if you are overweight, you will have a higher complication rate afterwards.
Wow. Okay.
And that, unfortunately, is the bottom line.
Okay. Yeah, so
I was part of an Enhanced Recovery After Surgery, ERAS program, which I didn't really understand.
Say that again.
Enhanced Recovery After Surgery,
ERAS. Recovery After Surgery. My God, I'm so impressed.
But that was the hospital. I didn't know anything about it at that point. But that means that they get you out of bed straight away. They walk you around the ward. You had to chew gum to get your digestive juices flowing. That was when I found out that chewing gum now comes in little sort of pellets rather than... sticks, last time I'd bought it. I can't remember the other thing, but, you know, but various things like that. And then afterwards, I started doing 10,000 steps a day.
And you're still doing that?
I'm still doing that, but I'm doing more now because Yorkshire Cancer Research has started a programme called Active Against Cancer, which is for both prehab and rehab, either for patients before surgery or afterwards. And I'm doing Pilates, yoga, some awful circuit training stuff, which is so hard. But that's all, it's a new thing that they're doing because all the research is showing that that's what makes the biggest difference to stop recurrence. And obviously, I don't want another recurrence.
Can I just check, is that right? Exercise, fitness is related to...
So it's not just recurrence, it's actually about getting over surgery. So forget all the technical innovations which have happened within our field, and there are many, and they have had their impact. The one thing, and Barbara's absolutely spot on about this, which has made the greatest impact is enhanced recovery. It's called after surgery, but actually it should be around surgery.
Yeah.
Because it starts beforehand with really good patient information, managing expectations, knowing what's going to happen to you, some knowledge about where you're going to be, so it's not frightening seeing the place that you're going to be looked after in, being prepared for a stoma if you're going to have a stoma, getting the information about that, even having a trial, using a dummy stoma, getting used to the idea of what's going to come afterwards. Around the time of surgery, it's the drugs that we use during the operation, it's the painkillers that are used. What you want to do is have a patient who's really, really got good pain control, but is not being sick at the same time, because a lot of the pain medications make people sick.
Right.
So you're looking at tailoring those so that the patient wakes up comfortable, able to take deep breaths, able to re-expand the bottom of their lungs after anaesthesia and surgery, so they're less likely to get a chest infection. You want them comfortable so that they're getting out into a chair the first day, onto their feet. The minute that happens, the chances of having a clot in the legs or the lungs diminishes, if the patient is able to achieve that. So you can see how with just very simple measures, we can actually dramatically enhance the recovery of patients after even very major surgery.
I should have asked you, did you get, and I hope I've got this right, Nicola will correct me if I'm wrong, did you get a condition called ileus? Is it ileus?
Yes.
I didn't get that, no.
You see, it happened to me. I mean, my guts just stopped working. And I think I got about 9 days before they put something through my neck, a PICC line or something it was called, through my neck and started feeding me intravenously.
Ileus is a dreaded complication. It actually affects probably around 15 to 20% of patients after colonic surgery. And as you know yourself, it's the one thing patients absolutely hate. You know, the vomiting, it happens because your bowel's not working. And patients hate the vomiting that goes with it. And what they hate most of all is the tube that goes in your nose to decompress the gut and keep you safe. The nutritional support intravenously is a great help to keeping you safe. But it's an area where we've got a lot of research happening at the moment,
right,
because of how difficult it is. ERAS is about trying to prevent ileus. So that's okay. where Barbara was talking about.
Perhaps that's what I didn't do enough of.
I
was pretty fit, to be honest.
There's no fault.
I was playing
fault.
Squash and
it just
stuff.
Happens. It yeah. just happens, and we don't quite know why it does. We know about ways to reduce it.
I'm going to try and bring us around to we're running out of time, basically. Looking back at, last 5.5 years? No, 5 years.
Just over five.
5 years. I mean, any kind of top tips about dealing with surgery?
Well, for me, it would be doing research, but that depends on the person.
Sure.
And because I can work out largely which sites are.
Okay, let me put it this way. You're obviously an incredibly confident person, okay? What if you're sitting next to somebody like Nicola and, you know, you're in their office, in their space? How important is it, do you think, to challenge, to question, to ask?
I think you've got to be careful because I think if you're too challenging and if you're suggesting that you don't have confidence in your surgical team or your medical team, that's not really very helpful. You've got to see yourself as part of the... part of the team.
Okay, what about, did you ask for a second opinion?
No, the only point at which I asked if it was time for a second opinion was when the second line of chemo stopped working. And the oncologist said to me, you know as well as I do what drugs there are, you know what order they're given in, a second opinion isn't going to change that.
Nicola, how would you feel if I sat, you know, you were advising me and I said, you know, Dr. Fernhead, I'd like to go and talk to somebody else. Would you feel offended?
Not at all. I think we know that decision-making, particularly with patients with stage 4 disease, it's complex and we don't have all the right answers. I've had no problem at all. What amazes me is how often the second opinion usually agrees with the first.
Right.
And most patients actually find that very comforting to know that their primary team actually was following the same lines. And very occasionally, there is something else that somebody has to offer, and that's where potentially, you know, using a second opinion in a specialist center may just give you slightly more options. And I would encourage patients to ask for that. I don't think that there's a surgeon in the country who would not be happy to offer that.
So it's as simple as that. I mean, so we're sitting across a desk, you know, you're talking to me about your treatment plan, and I can say to you, like a second opinion, Nicola, who would you recommend?
You can do that. And the other thing you can do is ask your GP.
After GP.
GP as well. So you can do either can be arranged that way. I think Barbara's right, though. You've got to be careful who you ask for that opinion from. You do want to go to somebody with a specialist interest in your area.
Just very, very quickly, Nicola, I think we haven't done this. I mean, you know, at the moment, it's your hands, your magical hands that are doing all this this surgery. Are we heading towards, I mean, we hear about robots and robotic surgery. Is that
so the advance, going to happen? The advances in surgery are both inside and outside. So within surgery itself, there's technical innovation. For example, robotic surgery, we know for some selected patients, it has an important role. Whether it's cost-effective will depend on the cost of robots coming down, but certainly the innovation is there. There are other things about making, technical things about making the surgery safer. For example, getting the join, making that less likely to leak is really, really important because that's
a
horrific complication when it happens and devastating for patients afterwards. So that is happening. But perhaps a bigger area of innovation is where surgery fits within the whole multidisciplinary team delivery of cancer care, because certainly we're seeing chances now where some patients can actually avoid having any surgery at all, with a combination in rectal cancer of being able to have radiotherapy, some chemotherapy, and sometimes depending on the tumour's profile and its genetic profile, which we've already touched on, it may be that the tumour melts away completely. So patients may not actually even need surgery. Or patients who have much too advanced disease, which can be downstaged, which can be brought back to a manageable stage where they can have surgery. And we're seeing more of that as well.
So, Barbara, you know, 5 years on, right now you're cancer-free. Before we sign off, I mean, how are you feeling? What, you've had all this, these operations. Are you prepared, if you had to do it again?
One of the things that I said just before the major surgery this summer was that actually it would be great if that surgery cured me, but I wouldn't change the last 5 years because it made me reassess what was important, what wasn't important. I've lived a better life, I think, as a result of all of this. If it recurs, and I know it's more likely to recur than not, I would have to look at what the potential outcomes of surgery would be, whether I would have it again. The surgeons sort of implied that, yeah, they could chop more bits off. No, you know, don't worry. We can.
I'm sure Nicola wouldn't have put it like that.
Probably not how he put it, but that was how I heard it. So again, it would depend when it came back, where it came back. I think I would make an informed decision on whether to have more surgery or not.
It's interesting, this thing, isn't it? You know, I obviously wish I'd never had cancer. But like you, I'm not sure that I'd give the last few years back. I've had such a rich life and a different perspective. Mm-hmm. I mean, isn't it a shame that we need to get something like cancer to live like that? But anyway, listen, Barbara Hibbert, Nicola Fernhead, thank you both very much for your time. In particular, Barbara, I'm sitting across from you. We're about 3 feet apart. You're an absolute inspiration. You've not stopped smiling through these last, whatever it is, 45 minutes or so. So thank you very much for your time. Well, I feel like we've explored the whole range of surgery available to people with bowel cancer and the importance of feeling, well, in control and asking a lot of questions about your operation. Thank you so much, as I've just said, to Barbara for speaking so eloquently about her treatment and, of course, to Nicola. All your, well, you've done something really special, actually. It's a very complicated thing, surgery, but you've made it accessible, I think, in this podcast. Thank you very much. Now, to find out more about surgery and bowel cancer, download or order for free Bowel Cancer UK's Your Operation Health Information Booklet. Visit their website, bowelcanceruk.org.uk.